Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. For most of this first hour, we are going to be talking about an incredible documentary that is about to take place on PBS that will be shown here Saturday, April 25th, Sunday, April 26th, called Shades of Freedom. It traces the power in history of slavery and how it affects America today. It's called An Historical and Artistic Exploration of How Slavery, Reconstruction, and Jim Crow Shaped the Agency of African Americans from 1619 to 1954. And joining us in studio is a woman who's bringing this event to Baltimore through her organization Civic Frame, April Yvonne Garrett, who just informed me that even though we have collaborated on many things, the first time she appeared in my show, so it's embarrassment one out of the way.
I know you love me, Mark.
I do. So it's good to have you here.
I am delighted to be here.
And we are honored to have in the studio Dr. Rosalind Tibor Penn, who is one of America's great historians, University President Emerita and History Consultant here at Morgan State University, and just one of the great minds of our nation. And she joins us in the studio. It's a pleasure to have you here.
My pleasure.
And a man who I respect a great deal and have known for a long time is just down the table from us, is Michael Higginbotham. And F. Michael Higginbotham is the Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore Law School. Michael, good to have you here as well.
Great to be here, Mark.
And on the phone with us now, is that right? Is he here with us now? We have with us Dante James. We have David Taft Terry, Executive Director of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. And David, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Mark, it's good to be with you again.
Always a pleasure to have you on the air.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about this series. I know in the next segment we're going to have Dante James, who is the producer of this series. But this, I watched a lot of this on the web last night and this morning, just to kind of get ready for what we were going to talk about today. But I'd like, April, if you could set A, what you've done here in Baltimore, and set up what this series is about.
Well, in 2002, I made a radical decision not to do PhD work because I'm a Baltimore native, and while I love the academic environment that colleges and universities have in its rich and robust dialogue space, I realized that we weren't having that type of rich dialogue within our own communities. And I was really concerned that this wasn't happening in my own community of origin. I am a Baltimore native. I grew up down the street on Marble Hall Road. And it became present to me that we were not creating spaces where people from diverse backgrounds, socioeconomically, educationally, were having conversations about the things that matter. So that was the genesis of Civic Frame. And we've decided to utilize intellectual work that's really accessible to everyday people, but also to utilize artistic work, most commonly documentary film, in order to have that be sort of an easier way for people to be introduced to complex contexts. So we have been lucky over the past few years to work with the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. It's a beautiful space.
Yes, it is.
I have a great deal of respect for David Taft Terry and his leadership of the institution, and we're both very concerned about its relevancy in the community, both locally, statewide, and nationally, but also reaching our target market and expanding that market to not just people of African descent, but all people who kind of exist in this area who are really interested in trying to find out more about the lives and histories and experiences of people of African descent. So I was really delighted when David and I actually sat down and talked about the ways in which Civic Frame and the museum could actually collaborate. And that's how we kind of came up with this film festival, actually, is what it is. We're going to be looking at three periods in history. When we initially had this conversation, David said, well, where do we start? And I said, well, if we're talking about the history of African Americans in the United States, we have to start with the Middle Passage and slavery. And we can go anywhere we want to go from there, but we really have to talk about these key periods. So we decided that we would start with slavery, Reconstruction, and Jim Crow as the three critical periods that we could introduce a kind of conversation about not just what happened to us in this country and in this context, but what specifically happened in the state of Maryland.
And I get let me just describe this a little bit too as well. I mean, it comes out of a series of documentaries done for public broadcasting.
Yes.
That Dante James produced. And
He produced the first, and then the other two, Reconstruction, the Second Civil War, and The Rise and Fall of Jim Crow, were also produced by others. So we have three separate documentaries that we will be showing excerpts from.
And the discussions taking place, some of the participants are here with us right
yes.
now. For Middle Passage and Slavery, Terry Owens will be there, but Dr. Philip Morgan from Johns Hopkins University and Rosalind Tibor Penn, who's on the studio right now, will be in that first panel. Dante James and Joyce Scott, one of America's great artists who lives right here in Baltimore, will be part of that, bringing that artistic sense to that. And in the second series, Troy Johnson will do the oratory, again, reading passages from history. Mm-hmm. Panelists will include Sherrilyn Ifill and Leslie King Hammond and Brian Morrison. And the final panel, Barry Sims will do in the oratory. And you'll have Jose Anderson from the University of Baltimore Law School, Michael Higginbotham from the University of Baltimore Law School, and Charles Hamilton Houston, who's the son of Charles Hamilton Houston. So let's do some history conversation here about what this is really about. And I think that's really is so fascinating to me. I mean, it's every time someone puts out a documentary or a new book that has to do with American history, especially the African-American world within American history, new things come to light. It's as if those revelations keep unfolding. And I think that, Dr. Torborg, I'd like you to just begin this, because, I mean, we always think that, you know, when we think about black history, African-American history, they set it aside in February. I'm glad this is not happening in February. It's happening in April.
Me too.
I get so tired of things just happening in February. That talk about, I mean, the importance, I think, for all of America to see the unfolding of African-American history and how it creates our identity as a nation, I think.
I think it's very important at this point in time because too many people think that because we have a black president that the era of racism is over. So we need to drive that home that this is not the case. And one of the ways to do that is to re-examine all of the eras that we have gone through in shaping African-American life, which also shaped American life. And when I was trying to get myself in the mindset for this, I went to a book that I bought from mm-hmm. the author back in 1997. The author is really an artist, Tom Feelings, who wrote a wonderful, what people call coffee table book, but it's more than that, called The Middle Passage, White Ships, Black Cargo.
Oh, yes, I know that book. Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
absolutely.
It's stunning. Wonderful. Yep. And when I purchased the book, it was at a book signing in Washington, and he was there, and I asked him. He said he was compelled to write this. It was almost like a spiritual thing. He couldn't go on with his work until he drew these unbelievable paintings, which reveal that slavery involved men, women, children. It involved the people who were enslaved as well as their enslavers. And it was amazing the way he did this. So I think that film, art, as well as literary texts have to inform us over and over again about our past and how the past is connected to the present.
And David Tapteri, I mean, talk a bit about the Reginald F. Lewis Museum and the role it plays in all this and kind of the importance you see in this and who you're trying to draw into this.
Well, I think April was on point. But first, let me say hello to everyone, and particularly Dr. Penn, my mentor and friend.
Mentor of many.
Yeah. Absolutely. Hi, David. Hi, David.
How you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
You know, I think the museum exists because of the type of sentiment that brings this program into being. That is to say, many of us from various walks reject the notion that we know all we need to know about African-American history and culture. If you think just a generation ago that it would have been possible for the type of energy and resources to be put into creating a museum whose sole purpose, or at least a major focus, was to explore the lives of African-Americans in, relatively speaking, such a tiny state as Maryland, mm-hmm. You'd have been laughed at. I mean, everybody associated African-American history with national narrative and characters like MLK, which is to say, in order to be authentic, you had to draw in something about these known quantities, that the things that were unknown were either unimportant or unknowable. But again, I think we're moving to that point in our understanding where we're seeking something deeper, seeking something different, and we are willing to re-examine some of these known scenarios within the historical narrative of American history, particularly from African-American African-American perspectives. I think what is most interesting to me in terms of the chronology that this project is going to look at is that early, those beginnings. That's why I was so glad April was able to get Dr. Morgan's involvement, because mm-hmm. those who are writing about early America are really setting aside some long-held notions. I mean, if you think about the radical days of the 60s, so much of the rebuff of what was trying to be accomplished was the old mantra, well, you can't legislate people's social behavior and attitudes. But thanks to the work of Dr. Morgan and others, we understand that that's exactly what happened in the 17th century, that working class people had an affinity for one another, and through the creation of slavery, through the trumping up or at least ramping up of racist ideas, you created this caste battle that reduced African Americans to 2 centuries and more of a second class experience. And we're only now just beginning to come out of that. So this, on one level, it's a shame that, you know, we wasted so much time as a society when our path could have been different. But also it's encouraging that no matter how long it takes, we have this initiative, this drive to get back to perhaps where we should have been in the first place. So it takes programs like this. It takes conversations about this. It takes bringing different voices, different perspectives to the table. This museum is about African-American history and culture in Maryland, but it has room for everyone's perspective. And in fact, if it doesn't have multiple perspectives and it isn't really meeting what it's supposed to do, because, again, that's how you have a conversation, through exchange.
And to give credit where credit is due, I April just slipped me a little note here saying, talking about A. Leon Higginbotham's work on race and colonial law, which is kind of a very powerful underpinning of how we came to the America and the understanding of race and even defining the notion of race.
Absolutely.
As we do in America. We actually, in many ways, though, there was a lot going on in the colonial world. America is the place that defined the notion of race and racism. I mean, that's where the birth
Absolutely.
Of all this takes place.
Most of the laws were created to prevent behavior that was already taking place. It was to punish people who were engaged in behavior that did not have the economic means. Well, not to say that there was some grand scheme and some insightful forethought, but if you look at how the laws came down, it was pulling people back across racial lines who had other ideas about how they socialize and who they marry and whatnot.
David Terry, it's always a pleasure to have you with us, and I want to just say that I'm so happy that you're in the position you're in at the museum.
Yes, yes.
And are taking that museum to places that we only hoped it could get. So thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
It's always
thank
an
you.
Honor to be with you.
Yep, bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk more about Shades of Freedom, this incredible series over the weekend, this weekend of April 25th, taking place at the Reginald F. Lowe Museum. And we have to talk a bit about some other stuff at this moment about the station you're listening to, and remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still here during difficult times to help people, and you can go to MECU.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are talking this hour about Shades of Freedom, this incredible historic and artistic exploration of how slavery, Reconstruction, and Jim Crow shaped the agency of African Americans from 1619 to 1954. And I might add, if I had a subtext, I would say shaped the entire country and who we are, and defines who we are like no other. It's another show we'll do one day about the power of the African-American culture on this planet and the world, which is one of the most powerful cultures in the world. We're talking about all that this hour and more. Shades of Freedom Film Festival is a two-day, three-part film festival highlighting slavery, Reconstruction, and Jim Crow, taking place at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum downtown.
Free.
April says free.
Free and open to the public.
April Yvonne Garrett, who's putting this event on, is founder and president of Civic Frame. In the studio with me is Dr. Rosalind Terborg Penn, one of our great historians, university president emerita, history consultant here at Morgan State University, mentor to many, many over the years. It's just an honor to have her even in the studio. Michael Higginbotham hasn't talked yet, but he will in just a minute. He is a Wilson Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. And joining us by phone is Dante James, the Emmy Award-winning producer and director of Slavery in the Making of America, which is going to be shown at this film festival.
The first film.
Dante, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, and thank you for the invitation.
And your Bible, I just want to let you know that some of your co-conspirators sent me the doll.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
We actually showed the doll last year.
That's mm-hmm. one. Right. Some people need to know more about Mr. Chestnut, but we'll do that another day.
Okay. But, yeah, the doll was my project following slavery and the making of America.
So it's they talk about the origins of this film and the series of films and what drove you to do the kind of work you're doing with this.
Well, the idea was to tell the story of the enslaved from their point of view. There have been other programs, series that have addressed this, mm-hmm. but it was never from the point of view of the enslaved. And that put a totally different interpretation and spin on the work. Also, we took advantage of some of the more recent scholarship that people like Ira Berlin from right there in
University of Maryland College Park. Yep, wonderful man.
And of course, Deborah Gray White from at Rutgers and so forth. Many of them had explored this issue from that point of view. So we had new scholarship to work with, and it was a joy to explore it.
And I think that is kind of what's one of the most remarkable things about this, and it would be great to hear both you and Dr. Penn talk about this for a minute. I mean, just the idea that there's other books have been written, we'll talk in the next hour about a book about Reconstruction also told from the perspective of the first black congressman elected during Reconstruction, which is and I think that the idea of seeing history from the perspective of slaves, from the perspective of free African Americans, from the African American perspective out to the rest of this country is something really very powerful and different. And it kind of shades a whole different way of looking at American history. Why don't you start that off, Dr. Penn, then we'll let Dante pick up.
Some of the newest research is dealing with the question of enslaved women. And I'm very happy to hear that Dante James consulted Deborah Gray White's book because she did the groundbreaking work on African-American women in the plantation South and their enslavement. But there weren't just women on plantations. There were women on small farms, women who worked in the households who were enslaved. And luckily, we have some of the slave narratives of several women. Some women who were enslaved and then later gained their freedom, like Sojourner Truth.
Mm-hmm.
There's a brand new book out on Sojourner Truth that Margaret Washington from Cornell University just put out. I'm not sure if the book is on the press yet. She sent me a copy because I read some of the manuscript, and it's a wonderful, groundbreaking book.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
About her life. So we're beginning to see small narratives, a little bit of information in church documents where women testify about their lives. But I think that's important to see slavery is not just men being enslaved, but families.
And I think that that's really a very critical piece, and this folds into this series as well. And Dante James, one of the I think things that's kind of opening up here was the part of the work you did in Slavery and the Making of America, the first in this series that you directed and produced, was the power of African culture and how it remained during slavery and what the excavations are uncovering, I think was really kind of very interesting work. You still there, Dante? Did we lose Dante?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I could barely hear the professor, but I can hear you just fine.
Okay, we can get you a little closer to my... We can even turn her mic up or see if we can get that... I'm sorry about that. Go ahead.
Yeah. But in terms of the series, one of the things that we wanted to do, which sort of piggybacks on what you were saying, is that we wanted to deconstruct many of the myths associated with slavery. And we wanted to show the enslaved as the full-fledged, proactive human beings that they were.
Right.
And to do this, what we made of a content or editorial decision is to try to never refer to enslaved people as slaves, because that objectified them from the very beginning. The idea was to think of them as human beings who were enslaved. And that was an approach that we used throughout the entire series. We also wanted, in terms of deconstructing these myths, we wanted to deconstruct the myth about slavery being a Southern institution. That's
right.
One of the reasons why we started the series in New York. We wanted to explore slavery in the North. We wanted to talk about the fact that slavery was different for men than it was for women, that it was not a universal kind of institution. There were no rules, no regulations. And as the institution evolved, people made it up and made up rules and did what worked for them in their particular situation, in their particular plantation, and so forth. And I think the most important thing is the idea that the enslaved were proactive freedom fighters. I like to think of that the first enslaved person who arrived in America as also being the first abolitionist. And the idea that people were proactive and they moved and worked towards freedom in many different ways. You know, some resisted and ran away. Some, in order to survive, acquiesced to the wishes and desires of the owners. Some did subversive kinds of things. But the fact of the matter is that all of these, or many of these, or most of these enslaved people were proactive freedom fighters and worked towards that end of freedom in many, many different ways.
Hey, Dante James, who will be here on Saturday, April the 25th. Pieces of his documentary are going to be shown. An hour worth, is that right?
An hour, yes, the first episode.
Slavery and the Making of America, you can meet him there. We'll also be on the panel with one of our guests today, Dr. Rosalind Terborch-Penn. Joyce Scott will be on that panel. Philip Morgan, who is from Johns Hopkins University, will be on that panel. And Terry Owens will be doing the oratory on that panel, reading a passage from an Anne Arundel County slave.
That's right.
That was found. All that's on Saturday evening. We have to take a short break here, and we're going to come right back to our guests. And Dante James, thank you so much for the work you do for all of us. I think you do incredible work as a filmmaker and documentarian. And I hope that one day we can have you on this air for a whole hour talking about that and more.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it.
I look forward to meeting you on Saturday.
Take care.
All right, take care. So we're going to take a very short break and come right back. And I want to remind you on the way to break that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait Program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Stay with us. Steiner, and welcome back. We're here with April Yvonne Garrett, founder and president of Civic Frame, putting on this incredible event this coming weekend for 2 days, 3 days of film.
Two days of film.
3 days of conversation.
Three films.
Get me all confused, April, please. You know, I get really confused very quickly, so.
Okay.
Shades of Freedom, and it'll be taking place, and one of the people who will be on the panel on Saturday is Dr. Rosalyn Turborg Penn, who is University President Emerita and History Consultant, Morgan State University, and joins us in studio. Also, Michael Higginbotham is with us, the Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Anybody on the phone? No, right? We're good. Yes. Yes? What are they telling me here? Oh, okay. Yes. Not yet. Okay. So, let's talk about what happens on the night that Michael Higginbotham is going to be part of the panel. And I appreciate you coming in, Michael. I know you're really busy. You have tons of teaching in two states to do and all kinds of other legal work and writing, but you're here.
And I'm denying you to be here. It's so important.
Can we get this mic right? Thanks, you.
So important. Can you hear me?
No, why don't we get you to slide on this mic? Just walk over here and get you. I'm sorry. I apologize, man. I do apologize. Well, we'll get you right here and this mic right here. And
as he's getting to that mic, I'll just give you a little bit of taste about how it's going to go. Saturday, we have two screenings. From 1 until 3, we will be showing the first episode of Slavery in the Making of America with the following panelists that we've mentioned before. There's also going to be a book signing from 3 until 4 with a lot of our panelists participating. Dr. Turborg Penn, Dr. Morgan, Joyce Scott, Sherilyn Eiffel. And we're also going to be selling other titles that will illuminate these three periods. Then we're going to go into the Reconstruction period from 6 until 7 p.m., and that will conclude Saturday. And then on Sunday, we're going to show The Rise and Fall of Jim Crow, one of the excerpts from that, from 2 until 5 p.m., and we have an incredible panel, a guest of panelists, including Michael Higginbotham, who will speak with you in a moment, Charles Hamilton Houston, Jr., which is so exciting because his father was known as the lawyer who killed Jim Crow, and Jose Anderson, who's also a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. And both Michael and Jose and Sherilyn Eiffel, all of these folks are on the board of directors for Civic Frame, so I'm very lucky that they're also an extended part of the Civic Frame family.
So, it's going to be an incredible event, and I think that it's the entire, everybody should go. It's free, by the way.
Free!
Free. You don't get many incredible film showings and intellectual discussions like this that are free. Michael, I'm sorry, welcome.
Oh, my pleasure to be here, and I was just going to say it's so important that Americans of all colors understand their history. It really is. And if you don't understand where you've come from, you have no idea of where you're going. And so I think it's just so important. And that's why I was delighted to sit here and listen, because even though I teach in this area, I learn something every day. And I've learned from just listening to folks about the new things that are happening in about race and history. You mentioned my uncle, A. Leon Higginbotham Jr., who wrote a groundbreaking book in 1978 called In the Matter of Color. And this was the book that opened it all up for me. I mean, I read about how racial discrimination was created in this country in terms of cases and statutes, which I had never really known about before. And people think about, you know, racial profiling today. And you look at In the Matter of Color and you see this is just a rerun today. Mm-hmm. Because In the Matter of Color shows that you had cases in the 1600s that were racial profiling. Mm-hmm. And so I just think it's so important to look back and know where we've come from. You also mentioned about the groundbreaking stuff that's coming out today. And it's fascinating to look at. I mean, I learn new stuff every day. There's a book about sundown towns, about how he had
We did a show about that when it first came out.
Yeah, right. great book. I mean, something that a lot of Americans didn't know about, that, you know, you had towns where blacks had to get out of town at 6 p.m., you know, when it before it got dark.
I mean, right here in Maryland,
absolutely.
Silver Spring, Tacoma Park, all those towns
Cambridge.
Were mm-hmm. sundown towns. That's why they built Rock Creek Park.
Yes.
Keep black folks on the other
on
side,
the side
so they can make sure you go home by sundown mm-hmm. and you're not loud.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to talk about on Sunday on my program. We're going to talk about Jim Crow laws and the extent of the segregation that existed in this country. I think a lot of Americans aren't aware of. They know about water fountains. They know about schools.
Right.
But segregation was so comprehensive. I'm doing some research on a new book I'm coming out with called Ghosts of Jim Crow. But I talk about the widespread segregation that existed and that people don't even know about. For example, in Tennessee, you had public windows in a public building that were segregated. They looked out over a beautiful pasture, and the windows were segregated so that blacks and whites couldn't look out at the same beautiful view. You had Bibles in courtrooms, some for blacks, some for whites. You had chess and checkerboards at YMCAs that, were segregated, so that it's so extensive, the segregation that existed.
So literally that a white person would not have to touch a chess piece that a black person had played with.
I think that's the gist that's the gist of it.
So talk for a minute about when you have this, the importance, in the few minutes we have left here, that of what you all be talking about over the course of this weekend, about what the power of this history says about today. I mean, I'm thinking about the book you said you're going to come out with. When you come out, this has to be your first stop to talk about it.
Absolutely.
Is The Ghost of Jim Crow, because that says to me you're talking about how the power of those Jim Crow laws still affects us here in the 21st century.
Absolutely. And we have made a lot of progress, and we don't want to lose sight of that.
Huge progress.
Huge
obviously.
Progress. Yeah. And we've eliminated...
We wouldn't be sitting here if huge progress hadn't been made.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we've eliminated the Jim Crow laws. But the reason why I call the book Ghosts of Jim Crow is because a lot of things still go on that manifest themselves that end up resulting in the racial inequality that exists today. You know, whether it's in schools, we still have tremendously segregated schools, whether it's in housing, whether it's in health care, criminal justice system. Racism manifests itself, but in different ways. It's no longer the law says blacks must be separated out, minorities must be discriminated against. But if you look at what ends up happening, we still have tremendous inequity along the racial lines. And so that's what this book is going to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the important things here, to before we round up, we only have a couple minutes left before we take a break and then talk about this incredible film out of Rwanda that Isaac Chung did. It's going to be at the film festival. But I want to talk about, for you as a historian, Rosalind Turborg Penn, the importance of that to now. We always forget that. You know, that history is about who we are today. It's not just about what happened to our fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers.
Well, I really am impressed with the title of your...
Me too. I love that title.
...forthcoming book, Michael, because The Ghost, I think, is really the legacy that we have now. And I think that folks assumed that you had to live in the South because that's where the Jim Crow laws were. But, I mean, the same kind of segregated school system has to do with where you live. And in many areas in the North, South, East, West, Middle America, you have the same thing happening, especially in urban areas, not just for blacks, but for Hispanics. And for people who have just low income.
Yeah, working poor.
So class, race, ethnicity often determines where you live, and where you live is where you're schooled for the most part. And if you don't get a good education because the school system is funded by the community and the community doesn't have the kind of money to invest in the school system, that legacy of Jim Crow has crossed over. And it's everywhere in America, which is unfortunate.
I want to turn this over a minute before we have to take a break here to April. We'll do it now. Tell us. Pitch one more time this week and make sure people are there. I want to make sure.
First of all, I have to be really clear that EAA is essential to the success of this film festival. And part of the reason why we named it Shades of Freedom is probably the same part of the reason that Michael talked about the ghosts. Because what we're dealing with is this history that is rich with regard to the immense constraints that were against people of African descent within the American context. But Sherrilyn Ifill actually... and part of this when she decided to do this, and she said, we're finally at a point in history where we get to talk about this from a space of, you know, being generative and a space where we're not being victims, but where we've overcome so much in a very significant way, especially with the election of our president. But we still have to deal with those details. So this weekend, we're going to be looking at this from the perspective of slavery. On Saturday from 12 noon until 3 p.m. We're going to have a book signing from 3 until 4 p.m. Reconstruction. We're going to be showing excerpts from Reconstruction, the Second Civil War, from 4 until 7 p.m. And then on Sunday, excerpts from The Rise and Fall of Jim Crow from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m. And again, Maryland Film Office, significant sponsor, Sojourner Douglas College, significant sponsor, NWEAA.
And you can go to WEAA's website, Steiner's website, and find more information. Make sure you attend. We'll all be there. I want to thank Dr. Torborg Penn for being here today. It's been a pleasure to have you in our studio.
Thank you.
Finally, great to have you in the studio with us. And Michael Higginbotham, always good to see you, my friend.
Always a pleasure.
And Emily Yvonne Garrett, thank you for doing the work you do.
Thank you.
We'll see you all this weekend.
Thank you.
Be there.
Great.
Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We've been talking about the Maryland Film Festival. One of these films that's going to be there is an incredible film, Munyu Rangabo. I hope I said that right. And our guest, Isaac Chung, who made this film, will tell us that was right. Isaac, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
And thank you for holding on. It's a pleasure to talk to you. This film of yours is just amazing. I must say, I was just blown away by it.
Oh, thank you very much.
And talk a bit about the Genesis film. Here you are, an American, making a film in Rwanda, in Kinyarwanda, in the language of Rwanda, not in French, not in English. Talk about that sojourn and what this film was for you.
Yeah, it's always interesting when I get up in front of an audience. I think that's the first thing people want to know. You know, they see a Korean-American guy standing in front of them, and they've just seen a film that's completely in the Kinyarwanda language and rooted in Rwanda. But really, it was never my plan to go to Rwanda and to make this film. I mean, it wasn't a long, thought-out plan, but my wife, she had been doing volunteer work in Rwanda for the past 3 summers before we got married. And as soon as we got married, I think one of the first conditions she made to me was that we have to go to Rwanda the following summer and go and volunteer and do something. So when she suggested that we do that, I knew that I needed to come up with an idea of what to do. And having taught cinema in the past and also, you know, considering myself a filmmaker, I decided I should make a film.
And a film you made. And this film, I mean, the story itself, I mean, it's a very moving, subtle story. Everything we've seen so far out of Rwanda that have been done by mostly Westerners, have done all by Westerners, actually, show in graphic detail the pain of massacres and ethnic cleansing and violence. You've taken a tact with this film that is about Rwanda now that is a much more subtle, gentle story, but powerful about that same story.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me when I was planning to make the film was that I had seen a few of these Western movies, and the primary goal of these Western movies was to reach a Western audience. So they have, you know, viewers in America and in Europe in mind, but they don't have the actual Rwandan audience in mind. And I figured, as a service to the Rwandan people, something I'd like to do as, I guess, an effort I'd like to call it an effort of love, even if that sounds very grand, was to make a film for them. And in order to do that, I knew that I couldn't focus on the actual genocide and what happened there and try to recreate it, because that would not be necessary, because this is already rooted in their memories. So more important is what's happening now in the country and the questions of what do we do with these memories that we do have and how do we go forward and attempt to have reconciliation. So that's really what I was trying to mine while I was there.
And the film you made with Rwandans, and I think the interesting piece of this also is that you're actually going back to help build a Rwandan film industry.
Yeah, that's the work that I've concluded is most necessary. in terms of cinema in Rwanda. I thought maybe it was just going and making a film, but I realized that it's to train and develop filmmakers there. So I've gone there. I've continued teaching the students I was teaching my first year when we made Munyarangabo, and they're doing pretty well. I mean, one student, he just showed his film, premiered it at the stadium in front of the president, and the president apparently loved the film, and he seems to be on his way, and a few others have won screenwriting competitions in Africa and are making their own films. So really, that's something I'm very excited about, the work over there.
And the way you approach this film and the story, because I just, if you give our listeners a sense of this story about these the relationship between these two young men, you don't have to give us the whole plot away, but this relationship between these two young men, I was taken by a lot number of things here. One was you really clearly showed the gentleness and affection that many men in Africa are unafraid to show one another, which I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who go to Rwanda, a lot of men especially, they're always a little bit surprised to have someone start another man hold your hand or, you know, put their arm around you for a long time. But this is just culturally the way that they react or they act towards one another. There's a lot of physical affection. And it's completely platonic, but these two boys, they were best friends in real life. So the sort of interactions that I tried to film with them were the ways in which they actually interact, you know, when the camera is not running.
And how did you meet them?
So the organization that my wife was volunteering with, they ran a program in which they mentor street children by taking them out to these soccer fields and playing soccer, and also on the side, helping them to get off of drugs and to find work and to, you know, get reintegrated into society. So these two boys were two of the guys who were living on the streets. And I had interviewed them in order to try to find more of a story for the film. And as I talked to them and listened to their stories, it just became clear that, one, that they'd be perfect for the film, and two, that their story should also be included in the movie. So I tried to be very true to the actual life experiences that they've had.
And how difficult was it to kind of film this in Kinyarwanda, the language of Rwanda? I take it you don't speak it, or do you speak it?
No, I don't speak it at all. I don't know. It was my first feature-length film, so I didn't have anything to compare it to, you know, to know whether or not it's very difficult. I've made short films in English, and most of the films I've actually made up to that point were in a foreign language. So it wasn't too difficult. It just takes two times longer. You know, I have to have translated what I want the actors to do, and then the actors try it out, and then that's translated back to me. I recently just shot a film in English, and actually I found that to be a lot more difficult than So, yeah, you know, we were pretty fortunate, I think, that the entire team, they were all pitching in and letting me know if someone had said something incorrectly, or if they're repeating certain words too often. You know, the entire crew was very good about helping me out.
So have you inspired, it sounds like you have inspired people to create films in Rwanda. I mean, some of the people, I mean, I was looking at the end of the film, and that the people working on it with you, on sound and in actors in this film were Rwandans.
Yeah, and actually, I wouldn't say that I inspired them to make movies. I think they already had this desire. I mean, it was a very strong desire. I think what we were able to do with this film is to show them that they can make movies on their own, that, you know, it's possible. It's possible to make a film and have it shown worldwide and to get their stories out.
This is an amazing film. And am I saying it right? Munyarangabo?
Yeah, that's very good.
And you're going to be at the film festival itself with the film?
Yeah, I am. Friday, I believe, I'm going to be there for the screening and do a Q&A afterwards.
I'm looking forward to meeting you. And just this film, I encourage everybody to see. It's just the most amazing film. Made the first film ever made in Kinyarwanda, the language of Rwanda. Thank you so much for being with us, Isaac Chung.
Thank you very much.
And folks, go to our website, steinershow.com, and you can see everything there is to know about the Maryland Film Festival and how to get tickets and how to get there. We're going to take a break, come back after the top of the hour with an incredible, interesting conversation by Philip Trey about his book, Capital Men, the story of Reconstruction through the eyes of our first black congressman. Stay with us.